Maureen Howard, your earlier novel, Bridgeport, Boston, that novel you describe the book as a feminist novel. Now, your leading character in Grace Abounding is Maud. Maud, of course, is a woman, but would you describe your latest book as a feminist novel?
No, I wouldn't, not at all. I really wouldn't describe Bridgeport Bus as a feminist novel, but it was before that genre reemerged. I was fooling with that idea when I called it a feminist novel. So I don't mind that tag being put on it, but I don't really like... The other day someone asked me about that, and I finally came up with, I hope, the correct answer. I said that I hope I'm a good feminist, but I'm not a feminist writer. Do you see the distinction?
What is a feminist novel?
Oh, I don't think... there should be such a category, really.
But you used the term yourself.
I was fooling, though. I really wasn't serious when I said that. I said I wrote a feminist novel before they reinvented that genre.
But there is
But I think, you see, what it implies is a kind of propaganda or sociological tract. And I'm not interested in doing that. I hope that I'm interested in doing something that appeals to all kinds of people and says a lot more than just that, just...
Yes, I think you're right. When you use the term feminist novel, whatever that means, it's meant to expand the views, the political and sexual views of feminists. But at the same time, I think it's important for women and for men to frequently write from the perspective of their sex, don't you?
Ah, yes, but that's different than saying that I write from a programmed idea. Just as with novels that we can look back to that are Marxist novels of the 30s or Marxist plays that grew out of that, they now seem very dated, some early Odettes and plays written and early WPA workshop things, because they were written out of that kind of propaganda. So they don't really survive. They don't have a larger perspective.
I have a feeling that the term feminism as such is probably going to be abandoned before too long, just because of the assimilation of women into all facets of our culture.
I hope so. I hope that it would, you know, there's a long, long way to go. But I would presume that if the goals are ever really achieved, and we do have a long way to go, then yes, drop that term. It's a good, yeah, that's a good suggestion.
Maureen Howard, I see you as Maud in Grace Abounding, but of course I don't know how much of Maud is actually you. Can you shed some light on that?
I don't know. I never feel that I am totally identified with my characters at all. I hope that they're created outside of me. Of course, I write Maud's background is perhaps something like mine, her education, her... and I suppose if I really wanted to push it, I'd say that I too am both held by the domestic life and family life and then want to flee it. But that's not unusual. Many women feel that. I love it. I think of myself as tremendously domestic.
I consider myself domestic, too.
I know. I do all sat outside our studio, and I sat and made out the list for all the things I have to get for Thanksgiving dinner. It's on my mind.
I worry sometimes about the confessional mode of writing, and in your memoir, Facts of Life, you describe your father as a terrible man, and, of course, you reveal some of the more unpleasant aspects of your life. How does it make you feel knowing that you have revealed yourself so directly to the reader?
Well, I too am against the confessional mode, and I think that one of the things that I say in that book, Facts of Life, is that I really don't like it, the confessional mode, so that I try to shape even the autobiographical, or I hope I did, as separate stories and to create a distance. It is true that I say my father was a terrible man, but the end of the sentence was he was wonderful, too. Terrible and wonderful at once.
Well, the fact is that you did show the good and the bad. I thought there were many positive things about your father in the memoir. But frequently, a confessional approach, now whether or not you would accept that description, can be a great disservice to the people around the author William Saroyan's son, for example, did what teenagers today call a number on his father. And, of course, Robert Lowell did the same thing, and to Elizabeth Hardwick. And I just wonder if it's necessary, in order to be a writer, to hurt the people around one.
I don't think it is necessary at all. In fact, I think it's a, except in perhaps the case of very great writers, I think that it's self-serving, and I don't think it does. I think that Lowell was constantly revising his life through his work and doing different versions of it, and it's too bad, really, that he came upon that period. It is not, to me, but anyway, that's not his strongest work, by the way, I don't think. I think the earlier poems, I don't think those late, very confessional pieces about Elizabeth Hardwick and his new wife and Harriet, the daughter, they interest me lots less. Do you see what I mean? I think he's less good.
Although Ian Hamilton, who wrote this new definitive biography of Lowell, believes that indeed Lowell's best work may have begun with Life Studies, which showed a lot of the beginning of this confessional mode.
Yeah, but I think it was so controlled in Life Studies. I love that control and the real sense of the poem that he was able to build then. And a very fine poet. But the confessional mode is just overwhelming in this day and age, isn't it? I was trying to avoid that. I'm tired of group therapy.
That's a very good way of putting it. As a matter of fact, I had John Barth before these same microphones a while back, and as you know, he is a professor of creative writing at Johns Hopkins. And he felt the same way. He is really not interested in reading about his students' dirty linen, as I think that's the way he phrased it. And he wanted them to do something more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're a teacher of creative writing. What are the young people today writing about?
Well, it's interesting. They are not. The ones that I've had recently are not doing quite so much surface, letting everything rise to the surface so quickly. They do tend to write highly autobiographical stuff. Though some of them escape. I call it escape because some of them start to write very fanciful science fiction. I don't think it's very good in that mode, but it's truly an escape. They do tend to write about themselves. I haven't found it to be as overwhelmingly intimate as it was a few years back. I think that they're beginning to feel that things should be structured again, and the distance of real storytelling and technique does come into the work when it's of a better quality. I hope.
Are people still writing like Kerouac and the people of the Beat generation? Of course, some of them are William Burroughs. They're still around, but it's been my perception that people aren't writing like that.
No, they're not. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that I would complain about I do complain about is that they really don't take risks enough. They tend to take on that whole aura that we're told exists in the early 80s of conservatism about jobs, and they've taken it right into their work so that their work is careful. They don't take any wild risks at all. You know, experimental fiction, whether you like it or not, if you're ever going to do it and have fun and try new things, it's when you're an undergraduate or when you're still studying. But there's none of that, practically none.
Mary Lee Settle, who has been here a number of times talking to me, believes that the best way to approach writing is simply to write a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Are people doing that now? Are your students doing that? And do you teach this?
Yes, they are doing that now. And no, I don't teach it per se. No, I don't think that. I have some students who are older, the older people are more experimental than the younger people these days, if that proves anything. I have a woman who's writing a very fine novel, and she read some of it at a gathering that Penn had a couple of weeks ago. It's much more free in its stylistically much more juicy and full of jazz than what the young people are doing.
Well,
they're doing imitation New Yorker stories according to formula. And
that would not make John Gardner happy.
No, it certainly wouldn't. God rest his soul.
Yeah. I can see teaching grammar and English and form and research and how to develop a plot, but how do you teach creative writing?
Oh, well, you don't. You really don't. I think that I did write a piece on this, or wrote a piece that involved my exasperation with it, and I call it the great non-subject of all time. It's a very odd position to be in, teaching creative writing. On the one hand, I feel that it's half therapy or psychotherapy, and the other half is dentistry. In other words, yes, you can fix their sentences and fill up the cavity of the semicolon and do all that. You're right, technical stuff. But on the other hand, it's a very personal one-on-one thing. One thing I like to do is bring in examples. I don't think you can write well unless you're reading things which feed you. I don't think you can dance well. I don't think there's anybody in Balanchine's group at the New York City Ballet that doesn't do hours and hours and hours at the bar before they go out on stage. So there's that kind of work to be done. Close reading, observation, you know.
Mm-hmm. How do you organize your day when you write?
Oh, I don't. I'm terrible. I get obsessed and I write forever and ever, and I wake up in the middle of the night and I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and I go at it hot and heavy. I'm not the kind of organized person who writes. Edith Wharton wrote until noon, and then the lunch began and the visits, and it was all very, very organized and very charming. It sounds so effortless. Obviously it wasn't. And then the rest of the time I feel that my life is all fragmented by phone calls, turkeys, shopping lists, you know. But I do like to retreat. I have to retreat from the world a bit and cut myself off. That's how I write.
I wonder about living in New York, and there are so many writers here, and everybody seems to have the same backdrop. I mean, is this a problem? Because when you write about the West Side, for example, when one writes about the West Side, you can see... I live on the west side of Manhattan, and I can see all of these images, and I just... If I were to start to write, I just wonder if I should remove my setting away from the place that I know so well, because everybody else is here writing. Does that have any impact?
No. I think it has a great impact, but I think one of the most important things to a writer is a sense of place. It is to me. And in that way, I feel that my hometown, Bridgeport, Connecticut, in a way, imaginatively, my sense of place is there. Now, by that I mean a commercial city, a city growing up in the 30s and 40s. That developed my sense of place. So that New York, in a way, has become an overlay, gives me another sense of place. But I think it's very important to feel that and feel it deeply and to use it, even to be parochial. And I don't mind that other people are using it. It's not just my territory. It wasn't only... Proust had Paris, but he wasn't the only one.
Well, that's
he
true.
Got it, though.
There's no place you can't write about, obviously, but sometimes I just would like to see something written about a place that I don't know about. And every other novel, of course, seems to have a New York setting. Even people who don't live here tend to write about New York. That's another story. I wanted to ask you a couple of things about our language today. We have a sexual explicitness that is available to us in almost everything we read, and our language is very explicit. And, of course, Grace Abounding is explicit in many respects. What is wrong about... writing a PG novel that doesn't have the sexual explicitness in the language that so many of our books, including Grace Abounding.
Oh, nothing wrong at all. I mean, I've written lots of things which have no explicit sex in them.
So why do it?
Because in this case, the only time it really comes up in Grace Abounding is when a woman is not really leading a full life, when she is drawn off and diminished by her fantasies. And her fantasies are really rather contained suburban lady fantasies. I find repetitive explicit sex in books very boring. I don't find it interesting, and I am amused and sort of bewildered by the fact that people do. I don't even find it erotic when it isn't done well.
Well, you grew up in the 30s and 40s, as I did. Does it disturb you that our language, whether it's in a book or in a motion picture or on the street, is so explicit today?
It has certainly changed. We never would have used the language when I was a kid. I'm sure you didn't freely use the kind of language we all use now quite easily.
Well, I never heard it until when I was in high school.
I know, when something goes wrong in the kitchen or when you stumble getting into an elevator, we all come out with the same two or three words. I think it's unfortunate and unimaginative of us, really, to have let this happen in terms of language. On the other hand, these words become so ordinary that they no longer really carry much value of shock, do they?
No. Some,
they've gotten so watered down now that it doesn't shock. In one way, I'm always torn about the idea of nice language or proper language, because I think that our language is fed by street language and the people's language. Look at Dickens, look at Shakespeare, to go to the two greatest examples. They really listened to everything, didn't they? They didn't know just a proper French Academy way of using their language. It was all okay to them. I like that.
Still, doesn't the explicit language destroy a certain market for a writer? For example, it would be more difficult to get Grace Abounding on a high school library shelf, I think, today because of that, than it would be for even Naked and the Dead, which had its language cleaned up by at least dashes, mm-hmm. Was able to do that. I just wonder, if you want to approach young people, because the school authorities are reluctant to let them read the material that is, I guess, we're used to, but I guess young people have to be led into society in a gradual sense. Doesn't it make it more difficult to reach these young people?
Yes, it does, and it's too bad. I also think it's too bad because there's obviously a double standard here. On the one hand, there's this beginning of a kind of book banning in America, which is unfortunate. And on the other hand, I mean, on the high school level, this is getting to be bad in sections of the country. And on the other hand, if you turn on daytime television, you know very well, and watch soap operas, what's happening in soap operas is extraordinary in terms of what these very same people don't want on the printed page. I gather, though I don't watch soap opera, that any subject whatsoever is now sort of on in the daytime. Isn't that right?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I think that now one can have incest, in all kinds of things that we never would have thought of as being part of the ordinary fodder during the daytime.
Don't they disguise it in some form? That
it's there. It's there. I think that if it wasn't cleaned up with kind of pretty little living room settings, and a lot of soap opera actors are awfully good actors and actresses, truly good, it is made palatable, and that's true of a lot of what's taken in movies and all kinds of things, but somehow the poor old printed page is getting dumped on.
Well, let me ask you about that. You've mentioned the television soap operas. Are you concerned about the video broadcast explosion and what it might be doing to literature today, and indeed just to reading and writing? Do you find, for example, in your college courses that students are coming in prepared to read and write, being part of the generation of the audio-video explosion?
Some are, but it really does begin to sort out that the ones who are ready to read and write have been pretty well educated on a secondary school level, at very good high schools, or at very good public high schools, or at good private schools. And the other kids have been just left to flounder. I spoke to a group last week of freshmen who really resent the fact that they were not properly taught. Nobody really told them they were going to have to write. To go back to the television generation idea, my problem with that is that I think watching television is basically passive. It's quite passive, isn't it? It's not like the kind of work you have to do reading a book or even watching a play, a very good play. It encourages passivity. And all I have to do is ask these kids, do you, when you sit and watch, Hill Street Blues or whatever, let's pick a popular program.
That was a bad choice.
I'm sorry.
One of the best ones.
I know, but I'm picking it on purpose. Do you sit there and do you use your mind? Do you say, oh, look, they've cut from this scene to this scene. Oh, look, this is really very well written, the performance that so-and-so is giving. And, aha, this is awfully stock. I know they did this last week, and they're doing a repeat of that. And such and such comic effect is going on. Do they? No. I don't think you'd ever get a television viewer, hardly ever, except maybe if they were taking a course, being trained as a director, would they ever use their mind that way? And yet we're expected to use our minds that way about literature, art, medicine, biology, people in business school. We are always supposed to, but not with television.
I think you are right up to a point, but I think that may be changing because video technology is becoming so inexpensive that people are beginning to buy their own cameras and to make their own movies at home. Books are coming out to show you how to do it.
Now that's good. Yeah.
And so it's no longer just an aloof entity sitting on a stand. It is now coming very close to people where they can actually manipulate it themselves and create their own programs. So this may change in the future.
Well, that's wonderful. That would be marvelous. Yes. Yeah.
One last question. What is ahead for Maureen Howard?
Oh.
Other than Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, other than Thanksgiving dinner, I have a plate that's too full. I always do. I have articles to write and things like that, but I'm all ready for one of my retreats from the world again in order to start to write something that I care about a lot. I have a list of things I want to do.
How do you mean retreat?
I mean start to read things I really care about, not answer the phone, not ever go to lunch, just stay in with my books and hole up. And that's how it starts for me. The crazy dream world takes over, and I like that.
Thank you very much. We talked longer than I expected. I hope you didn't mind.
No.
I have a lot to cull through here.
It was fun. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for coming. And have you had a lot of reaction to the book up to this point?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it's doing well.